Welcome, Dumbheads, to this week's Megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one episode per day, identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Heroes Unlimited, the gloriously ramshackle superhero RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the week's previous episodes in one Megasode, like this one. If you'd like to play along at home, we're reading Heroes Unlimited Revised 2nd Edition, 2nd Printing, from December 1998. Today we're discussing page 330 of Heroes Unlimited. We're still in the Magic Explained section, talking about all the different spells that magical characters can learn. This show has a format, because it's a daily podcast, and God knows it's digressive enough without me sitting here with no plan and no subject matter and just bullshitting into a microphone for 10 minutes or whatever. That's no way to cast a pod, so I need a format. However, you know, the topic of this podcast is the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Heroes Unlimited. And sometimes the dumbest thing on a page is boring. Now, if everything on the page is boring, then, you know, I just kind of got a vamp. But sometimes there's a dumb, boring thing on the page, and then there's something else more interesting that I'd rather talk about. Normally, this is because that other thing angers me. Today is one of those days, and I'm going to follow my heart. We're going to do the format. Don't worry. Don't hit me up on coffee trying to take back your donations, for which I'm very grateful. I am going to identify the dumbest thing on this page. But once those boxes are ticked, I just want to take a minute to talk about one of my pet peeves in gaming. So, okay, let's tick those boxes. The dumbest thing on this page for my money is the spell Heal Self. It's a very simple spell. You cast it on yourself. It costs 20 PPE. It restores 1d6 of either your hit points or your SDC for every two levels of experience you have, so it scales. This spell's presence here is dumb for reasons that should now be quite predictable, given my complaints about the rest of this section. There's already a spell called Heal Wounds. It's a two-level lower spell, it costs half the potential psychic energy, and for many applications and at many levels, it is better, in some cases strictly better, than Heal Self, which is a higher-level spell that costs twice as much. Heal Self obviously can only be used on yourself, whereas Heal Wounds can be used on anybody. Secondly, Heal Wounds does not scale, so if you're high-level, then Heal Self is a better choice, assuming you only need to heal yourself. And while the cost of Heal Self is higher, there's a question of action economy. So basically, and I did the math on all this, it runs down like this. At caster levels 1 through 2, Heal Self is strictly inferior to Heal Wounds. At level 3, it becomes better only in scenarios where you need to restore your own HP under time constraints. So like, I need to get my own HP back in a hurry, but not such a hurry, like I'm not in combat. Then finally, at level 5, it is straight up more efficient to heal hit points with Heal Self than with Heal Wounds, because your HP healing rate has scaled to the point that you're now getting a better bang for your buck on PPE if you heal your specifically hit points, not SDC, with Heal Self. All of this is terribly dull. I understand that. I know what I'm about. That's why we're not spending most of the episode talking about this. These two spells are different in ways that are not fun, not very significant. Really, the only time they're going to come into play is a situation where you're under time constraints, you're down to your hit points, which, by the way, you shouldn't be. If you're a wizard, what are you doing? I mean, we're in a game where it's not unusual for characters to have 100 plus SDC. Some characters may have hundreds. Granted, a wizard isn't likely to. Even a wizard could easily have 60, 70, if they're a boxer wizard or an assassin wizard, as they should be. If you're at the point where somebody is just standing there beating the shit out of your wizard until you're down to hit points, you know, that 20 or so points of like life-threatening damage you can sustain before you die, you shouldn't be in that situation. That's why wizards dress the way they do. You can't fist fight somebody with those big hanging sleeves, hood hanging down, slipping over your eyes while you're trying to fight. Because if you're in a foot chase that then turns into a fist fight, you're already fucked. Just get a head start on casting reincarnation, because this incarnation is fucking done for. But it really is only in that scenario where you are down to your last few hit points and you need to get them back in a hurry, but not too much of a hurry. Because again, if you're in the middle of fisticuffs in the street, you don't want to be spending two punches worth of time to heal a half punch worth of damage. That's how you lose wizard boxing matches. And once again, as we've talked about before with other spells, it's not so much that either one of these spells is bad, it's that there's no reason at all to have both of them in this game, with such limited space on the spell list. So what would I suggest to take its place, you ask? Or maybe you don't ask. My vow binds me either way. It doesn't matter what you ask. How about this one? From Heroes Unlimited Revised, Teleport Self. This is a mid-range teleport spell that allows you to teleport only yourself up to a maximum range of like 5 miles, and that's pretty much it. It's a very simple spell. It would have been a much better choice to have in like multiple iterations, to have like a lesser version of teleport plus a better version of teleport later, than this heal self, heal wounds thing, where there are two spells that basically have the same functionality. The only really interesting difference is the fact that you can use one of them on other people. Whereas with teleport, the ability to teleport yourself versus teleport yourself and allies is fundamentally a different ability in the way that it affects the campaign. When you can teleport the party, that's a party asset. That's a thing that affects how the group can approach situations. Whereas when you can only teleport yourself, that's good for, you know, herring off on your own, going on a recon mission, using it tactically, but it doesn't give the party the ability to initiate an attack or an adventure by all teleporting in en masse. So it's a fundamentally different thing in the way it affects the campaign, so you could have two different spells for it. Also, that range of about 5 miles is a moderate range that is in between the two other spells that are in second edition. Sadly, that middle level of teleport functionality was removed from Heroes Unlimited second edition to make space for redundant healing spells, among other things. I think this kind of decision-making really does reveal a lack of sophistication that I don't necessarily pin on Palladium specifically, or the author of this book. It was a different time in gaming when this game was made, certainly when the original Heroes Unlimited was created, but even in 1998, the indie gaming thing was not huge yet. The more sophisticated way of analyzing the mechanics of a game in terms of their effect on the story, that had not really come around yet. We were still in a mode, for example, of Dungeons and Dragons, where we were thinking about simulation. We were thinking about, like, well, you know, based on what I know about a beholder, what would their living room look like? Where would they poop? What kind of food chain supports a multi-eyed, gas-filled abomination? I feel like, you know, there may be isolated instances, but it wasn't until later that we sort of all universally adopted the game design technology of, like, what we need to know about beholders and figure out about beholders is how they affect a D&D session where you go and beat the shit out of a beholder, or more likely, a beholder beats the shit out of you. The gameplay experience is primary there, not the sort of logic of the fiction of the world. Both are important, but we're playing a game, and so gameplay drives everything. Certainly, it drives your choice of what to put in your rulebook and in your rules. And in this case, having multiple tiers of teleportation really does drive gameplay in different ways, depending on what level the characters are at. Whereas having these two different healing spells, none of that meaningfully drives gameplay. None of that changes the way we approach the story or the way the story unfolds on a deep level. So, cut one. We've also got an entry in Blind Watch today, the spell Invisibility, and then in parentheses, Superior. This is super extra invisibility. You're so invisible with this spell, dogs can't even smell you. You've transcended the whole physical spectrum. You're literally so invisible that your shit doesn't stink. This is the absolute king of invisibility. You're so invisible that even people who can see the invisible can barely see you. It says here, quote, "The power to see the invisible will only reveal a semi-transparent, ghost-like image of the character, which gives attackers a penalty of -2 to strike." You also get a prowl of 84% because on top of being invisible, you make barely any noise. However, this version of invisibility is different from simple invisibility in that if you attack while under the effect of the spell, then the effect is broken. So this truly is for stealth, not for fucking people up with knives or whatever while they can't fight back, which is, you know, what player characters typically use invisibility for if they can get away with it. As with invisibility, invisibility superior does not give the important stats that you would need to actually run the power. You've got to infer them from other versions of invisibility found elsewhere in the book. But there's no other power quite like this. I mean, insofar as this is invisibility, insofar as you're someone that your opponent can't see, therefore what penalties would they take for attacking you? I guess you would compare it to the superpower invisibility, just like you would for simple invisibility. So I guess by default, the two spells match since neither of them have rules. And you've got to make your best guess for both. And for me, the best guess would be the same for both. So in that sense, I guess these rules match. Like, I, the reader, am being left to do all the work, and I choose to do the same work in both occasions. So the rules agree for once, because I did it, because I made them match. Yay for me. However, I can't technically call this a win. I can't technically call this a match, because this spell has an additional effect. You're so invisible, you're super invisible, that your super invisibility up against C invisibility balances out to, like, almost invisible, this, like, weird ghostly state where it's, like, even a person who can see the invisible, even a person who can see into other dimensions or whatever, has to, like, squint to see you, and that gives them a -2 to strike. Now, there is, albeit limited, precedent for this in other places in the rules. Notably, the intangibility superpower gives you a ghostly, semi-transparent appearance when you use it, and there, no penalty to strike. So close. Some of these are so close. But once again, if we do the work to search across the whole breadth of this fucking book to find comparisons to fill in the rules that aren't given, when we do finally unearth those rules from secret caches throughout the book and lay them out on the table before us, we find that they don't match. Although, who's to say? I mean, there's no strictly comparable power to this, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm fully familiar with the idea of almost invisible. Like, who am I to judge? I'm not a doctor of invisible. Who knows? But on Blind Watch, we're looking for rules that match exactly, and these rules don't match exactly, so there you have it. And with that, the boxes are ticked. You may notice that section of the podcast, kind of light on jokes, like it's just a gameplay observation. That's why I didn't really want to talk about it. What I really want to talk about is a spell called Metamorphosis : Animal. This is one of a number of metamorphosis spells. It allows the mage to turn into other creatures of various kinds, like another person, or a monster of some kind, or whatever. There are some in Heroes Unlimited, there are more in other sources. This one allows you to turn yourself into an animal, and it falls afoul of my perennial foe, one of the worst things in game design, and specifically magic design, in role-playing games across the whole spectrum of gaming. I'll just give you the quote, I'll let the spell speak for itself. Quote, "The invocation can completely transform a character into a particular animal, from an alley cat or cocker spaniel to a lion, wolf, alligator, bird, etc. In animal form, the character gets all the inherent abilities and defenses which that animal form may offer, but retains his own IQ, ability to speak, memory, SDC, and hit points." So turning into an animal is a classic mage ability. Real life literature and legend is full of stories of magical people who can like turn themselves into animals in various ways. You can't not have this in your magic system if your magic system is meant to represent like a traditional folkloric or literary view of magic. It's hard to implement. I understand that. I know it's a challenge, but my demands are not so great. If I take a spell that allows me to turn into a wolf, I just want to be a goddamn wolf. I want to do like a wolf does. I want to run through the woods. I want to have vicious fangs. I want to have a good sense of smell. You know what I don't want? The SDC of a beardy, anemic, goddamn floppy robe-wearing wizard. I don't want to be a nerd wolf. I want to be a jock wolf. I mean, sure, I might go, you know, track people with scent. I might turn into a wolf, you know, for speed. And that's fine. Like, those are abilities that a wolf should have and does have, according to the rules presented here. There's a helpful little table that tells you the typical speeds of different kinds of animals, what kind of damage their claws and teeth do. And that's all fine. But if all I wanted to do was track somebody down by scent, I would have turned into like a basset hound or something. Something small, something cute. Something that maybe in a pinch can ride public transit. You're not supposed to let a basset hound on a public bus, but if one got on there, the driver wouldn't be like, oh my god, we gotta pull over and kick this basset hound the fuck off on the side of the road. I think the driver would be like, hey, whose basset hound is this? Like, you can buy yourself some time. If you're a wolf, shit, I mean, how are you supposed to even wait at the stop if you're a wolf? I mean, granted, people are more likely to leave than to try to get you out of there themselves. Although, I'll be honest with you, I'm an inveterate user of public transit, and I've certainly regularly used some bus stops where a wolf had better fucking watch himself. My point is, for utility, you would go with like a small, unobtrusive animal. If you're turning into like a wolf or a bear or a lion, it's because you want to go fuck somebody up. You want to fight like a wolf. And you can't fight like a wolf when you've got the hit points and the SDC of a wizard. Now, you could say that this problem is ameliorated somewhat in Heroes Unlimited by the fact that everybody is so goddamn buff. Like, since everybody needs to take boxing, everybody's pretty much encouraged to take physical skills. You get random boosts to SDC from super abilities and things like that. The average superhero, even if they're a non-combat superhero, like a wizard, is likely to have an SDC that rivals even a tough natural animal. Heroes Unlimited never gives us exact numbers for how tough a wolf is, but fortunately it does give us a reference to another Palladium book that tells us that, the Palladium Book of Monsters and Animals, 2nd edition. And if you check in this book, which is truly a delight for anyone whose campaign has ever required them to ask, how hard is it to kill every individual kind of songbird? If that's you, this book is right up your alley. It has detailed stats for like every kind of animal. It does have wolves, and wolves have an average of 20 hit points and 27 SDC, because we're on Palladium Fantasy scale. Even a jungle Kodiak, otherwise known as an Ernie, this is a gigantic jungle bear, it's like over 2,000 pounds, it has an average of 50 hit points and 65 SDC. That's a total of 115 damage it can sustain. And I mean, that's tough, but it's not out of the realm of possibility for what a starting character would have who doesn't even really have toughness powers. If you've got good physical skills, maybe a random super ability like Winged Flight gives you a big SDC bonus for whatever reason. Maybe you're even a superhero who's, you know, third level or something, so you've got those couple extra dice of hit points. You could easily have that much total damage capacity. So you might think, okay, this isn't such a big problem, because in all likelihood, your wizard is going to have more damage capacity than a wolf would. I mean, it's stupid, but it's true. But that doesn't solve the problem of what you want to be able to do in wolf form, for two reasons. Number one, player characters are outliers. A first level wizard is outrageously tougher, in all likelihood, than an average person, just for no reason, just because they're a player character. and a superhero. But when it comes to basic biology, you know, knowledge of boxing aside, a wolf is tougher than a person. Certainly a gigantic jungle bear is tougher than a person. So when a tough person changes their body into the body of a wolf or a 2,000-pound bear, they should get tougher, shouldn't they? So that's the logical argument. The gameplay argument for why this spell doesn't do what you want it to do is, look, if my, you know, 60-odd SDC that I have as a first-level wizard who knows how to box were enough to just rock up to a supervillain and kick his ass, I would just do that. I would save the PPE, I would hike up my robe and stuff it in my pants, cinch up my big floppy sleeves with a scrunchie, and just go beat the shit out of him, if I could, but I can't, because it's a superhero game that anticipates big bruisers, and I'm not one. I'm just a dude, albeit a weirdly tough dude because it's a superhero game. And turning into a wolf, if it's not giving me enough SDC to go be a frontliner along with super strong mutants and battle droids, then what am I supposed to do as a wolf? Just sniff around the battlefield during the fight, looking for helpful items? This isn't Secret of Evermore. If I'm a wolf, I want to kill people. I want to be a jock wolf. I don't want to be stuck looking for alchemical components like a nerd wolf. This is something that so many games do badly. Everything from like the D6 system, which has a truly horrible animal metamorphosis ability where shapeshifters have to individually buy every ability they want from the animal they turn into. So like by default, if you turn into a bat, that bat can't fly. Horrible. I'm not even going to get into the shit show that is Polymorph in all the various versions of Dungeons & Dragons. Suffice it to say that in many versions of Dungeons & Dragons, playing a wizard who actually is a wolf is better supported than playing a wizard who can turn into a wolf. More mechanically sound. I think it tends to be more freeform games that actually get this right. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You got to start with the gameplay. If I'm turning into a wolf, I want to be a wolf. I want to go tear people apart. I want to find them with my sense of scent. I want to chase them down with my wolf speed. And then I want to rip into them with my wolf fangs. And then I want to howl. You give me all those things, I'm fine. But you got to start from that and then write the spell backward to make sure I can do those things. Unfortunately, metamorphosis colon animal gives me everything but that. It allows me to continue talking. Once again, like a nerd wolf. I'm like a wolf who's a wizard and all the other wolves are fighters. And I got to hang back and cast spells. I get to keep my own IQ in memory. So like I'm a wolf with a lot of skills, but I need to hide behind the other wolves. What's the point? I'm already a wizard. I can already hide behind a wolf. Wizards with improved familiar do it all the time. I want to be a wolf, a jock wolf. And while I get lots of useful abilities from this spell, and it's not the dumbest thing on this page because this spell has plenty of utility. It's a thing lots of people are going to want their spellcaster to be able to do, so it deserves its space. It does take up a big chunk of space, but that space is relatively well used, giving nice general rules for all the different types of animals. It's just this one blind spot. It's just keeping your wizard SDC. The fact that no matter what animal you turn into from the spectrum of God's creation, they all have the same amount of physical toughness as a puny wizard. It just ruins this spell for its most dramatic applications. So that's like a pet peeve of mine for magic design. Don't do this with your game. If I can turn into a wolf, let me be a wolf. Anyway, this has been like an analysis heavy episode. I hope you don't mind. I'm passionate about this one pet peeve, but as usual, my passion expresses itself in the form of wonky game design critique. I am who I am and I want what I want. Today we're discussing page 331 of Heroes Unlimited. We're still in the Magic Explained section in the spell list, and we're getting into the big guns now. This page ends 7th level spells, it begins 8th level spells, so we're really working our way up. Any spell after this level, like 9th level and later, there's all kinds of weird stuff that applies to it. It takes longer to cast, it's much rarer for characters to get spell slots to cast these spells, so we're kind of entering the end of like the standard spells and getting into the spells that are a big deal to know and to cast. Because level 7 is also the first level where you can learn ritual versions of spells. This game does not have circle magic, as I keep lamenting, but it does have ritual magic, which is similar, except not cool at all. There are no pictures, first of all. You don't get unlimited power. You don't need to use any animal parts, at least not rules as written. Basically, all it is you know a version of the spell that is much slower, but the difficulty to save against it is higher. So it takes you like at least 10 minutes, some variable number, 15 minutes plus for very high level spells. And yeah, the save difficulty goes up to 16. For a lot of spells, this is a meaningless difference. So mainly this is sort of flavor. Like the idea is starting with 7th level spells, these are spells you would give enough of a damn about to cast them as big rituals. They're not just stupid wizard tricks. The fact that we're in the big leagues now is part of why the dumbest thing on this page upsets me so. Bad news for fans of Heroes Unlimited Revised. I'm not giving you any cool content from Heroes Unlimited Revised today because I'm not talking about something that doesn't belong in this book. I'm talking about something that does belong in this book, but is just ill-served by the rules as written, and that thing is Eyes of the Wolf. It is a cool spell, a flavorful spell. Just listen to that name, Eyes of the Wolf. Can't you just imagine casting it and having, like, the special effect of, like, the phantasmal Eyes of the Wolf rising behind you, like the attract screen from Altered Beast? It's cool. There's flavor. Contrast with, like, Energy Bolt, Mystic Shield, right? If I'm looking at a spell list, I'm for sure giving Energy Bolt and Mystic Shield a miss, and I'm flipping it right to Eyes of the Wolf to see what that cool spell does. The answer, sadly, is the following. It's a spell you cast on yourself or somebody else nearby, costs 25 PPE, which is a big solid chunk of PPE, and it gives you the following modifications to your vision. You get 20/20 vision, but you lose your color vision, so you see only in black and white. So this is not even like actual canine style limited palette vision. This is full on 1950s television style, grayscale everything. You get night vision out to 100 feet. You can see the invisible 75% of the time, which is, number one, worse than a wolf. I just have to point that out. We do know a thing about wolves. They are animals, and therefore they can see the invisible, per the psionic section. Once again, this wolf-themed spell relegating me to be a scrub wolf. I don't want to be a scrub wolf. I want to be a big wolf on campus, which either was or should have been a 1980s movie. I digress. So you can see invisible things like 75% of the time, which, considering that invisible people generally want to kill you in role-playing games, is not a great percentage. Like, I wouldn't buy a carbon monoxide detector that detects 75% of deadly carbon monoxide leaks, which are, of course, the real-life equivalent of the invisible assassin. You can identify tracks 85% of the time. So just like a wolf, if you run into some tread tracks in the wilderness, you can look at them with your wise wolf eyes and be like, cheap Grand Cherokee. You can recognize poisons 65% of the time. Again, not a great percentage. Again, not a traditional area of wolf expertise. And finally, and maybe most importantly, you can identify plants slash fruits at a 70% skill level. Because if there's anybody who can tell an apple from a plum at 200 paces, it's a wolf who sees in black and white. Despite my objections, this is still a cool spell. It's the ability to see a lot of stuff you can't normally see, and that's great. Oh, I forgot to mention tracking. You can track 50% of the time by sight, not by smell. Note, this is not Nose of the Wolf. You don't get to track people by scent. You got to use your powers of visual deduction, which, don't get me wrong, I mean, it's not as cool as a wolf tracing the scent of blood through the wilderness, but a visual Adrian Monk-style deduction is pretty impressive, especially considering that if you're tracking someone at night, you're only able to see 100 feet out and without distinguishing color per this spell. So you're tracking with all the visual acumen of a wolf looking through a liquor store security camera. Ultimately, the applications of Eyes of the Wolf are not really my problem. It's a package of different visual abilities. It's got a nice long duration. So if you know you're going into a situation where somebody's going to try to spring something on you, you know, could be poison, could be an invisible trap, could be fruits, you know, could be a clever fruit-based puzzle death trap. Like, only one of these three dates belong to the true Son of God. That looks like the date of a carpenter. Thanks, wolf senses. But if you're going into that kind of situation, then you activate Eyes of the Wolf, and then you've got this whole suite of different visual abilities, which is not something wolves are really known for, but fine, it's cool. My objection is a broader one, and it applies to a lot of things in Heroes Unlimited, but I think specifically spells, because spells are a number of things. First of all, it's really hard to get spells. You get a small selection. Learning new ones takes a long time. There's often a random element involved, and it may be like an in-character quest to get a spell that you really want. So spells represent a major investment of a lot of different resources. Speaking of resources, they cost you something to use. Once you know the spell, you still have to spend PPE, which is a quite limited resource. I mean, a first level character might have Eyes of the Wolf, and let's say she does. Let's say this wizard is first level, but the player is just like really into wolves, as sometimes happens at the gaming table. And so she picked up Eyes of the Wolf right away, despite the fact that it's an 8th level spell. This character's probably only got, what, 87 PPE? Spending 25 of that for 8 minutes of fancy wolf eyes, that's a lot of eggs in one basket, right? You're really paying to use this spell, in addition to the slot you've sacrificed to have it in the first place. And finally, in terms of table time, spells take a long time to use relative to other things. You know, if you've got the ability to shoot lasers out of your eyes, or if you're just a vigilante who likes to lay into people with nunchucks, you get to go every action, but spells take more than one action to use. And also, wizards tend not to have a ton of actions per melee. You know, they can get an extra one from boxing, they can take hand-to-hand skills, but they're not getting extra actions from superpowers little miscellaneous bonuses from their power category, etc., etc. So in terms of like the player's time at the table, casting a spell is also a bigger chunk. You get to act less often, but when you do, you get to use a spell. A hard one, expensive spell. And my problem is that spells, like a lot of things in this game, often fizzle anticlimactically. There's no failing forward in this fucking game. You don't fail forward, you don't fail sideways into like another interesting situation. You don't even fail back. Like, this is not like a paranoia, let's say, where a failed roll is likely to provoke a possibly fatal setback from the creative GM. A lot of times, when you cast a spell, the worst thing of all is going to happen for having fun at a gaming table, which is just nothing. Just a big fat nothing taking up space. For some of these applications of Eyes of the Wolf, that is acceptable. So like, see invisible, right? The player knows, the GM knows, that it's a 75% chance to see the invisible. So if you use this spell, there's a percentile rolled at some point, maybe behind the GM shield, and you don't see anyone invisible, but maybe there's someone there. Maybe you just rolled badly. That's a failure, but it's leading to a dramatic situation. You gain information, but at the same time, the tenor of your situation has changed. Similarly, recognize poison. You know, if you cast this spell because you expected there to maybe be poison, maybe the spell helps you, maybe it doesn't. There's still some tension about whether you're going to get poisoned. I do have a problem with track, because that's one of the main uses of this spell, in my mind. You might turn this spell on as a sort of general buff to see danger, but you know, see invisible is a much lower level spell. It costs like 4 PPE. If you think there's an invisible assassin on the loose, you know, peace of mind is worth 4 PPE. 25 is a lot to spend to maybe not get killed. So you might use this sort of reactively in a scenario like that if it's a spell you happen to have on hand. But very often what'll happen is when you want to track someone, you want to do something proactive, that's when you would use this spell. And a 50% chance to track that never gets better is not only weak, but it's boring because you cast this badass sounding spell, Eyes of the Wolf. You know, it takes you 2 actions. It costs you 25 PPE. You know, maybe even if you're like low to mid level, maybe a quarter of your total magical potential for the day on this spell. So you can track somebody and then nothing happens. Just nothing. The most egregious one, though, maybe the most inexplicable, is goddamn identify plants / fruits. First of all, this spell shouldn't have this ability. Wolves are not fruit connoisseurs. Wolves famously have very little interest in fruit. Do not offer a fruit basket to a rampaging wolf. You'll only make it angrier. But if you're going to have this ability, and if you're going to have a spell that costs you 25 goddamn PPE, and it gives you the ability to identify fruits, 70%, there's a 30% chance that you summon forth your mystical powers, this spell you begged your master for years to learn, and finally you focus your Vatic gaze upon the mystery fruit before you, and you're like, I don't know, Tangelo? Is that a fruit? No, fuck that. I almost guarantee you that if you have this spell, you will never be called upon to identify a fruit. But if you are, I feel almost like that should be 100%. And honestly, the failure rate for all of these is too high, especially considering, I mean, this is Eyes of the Wolf, right? It's an 8th level spell. Please consider that back in 7th level, we had a little spell called Metamorphosis : Animal, aka Everything of the Wolf, that allows you to actually turn into a wolf. Now, granted, it's a shitty wolf, a wolf who can't fight, a wolf who wears spectacles, a wolf who walks through the woods carrying his book bag, and then other bigger wolves run up on him and knock his bags over and then run off laughing into the night. That kind of wolf, but a wolf nonetheless, a whole ass wolf. You get claws, you get the nose, you get the eyes, you get everything. You get, quote, extraordinary vision, approximately 10 times better than a normal human's. So already, Eyes of the Wolf gives you 20/20 vision, good vision. This gives you vision 10 times better than a person. It also gives you night vision 600 feet out, 6 times as far as Eyes of the Wolf. It doesn't give you an ability to see the invisible 75% of the time, but it does give you an extraordinary sense of smell, which means that, number one, you'll always know when there's someone invisible around, instead of only 3/4 of the time, and number two, you'll always take only half the penalties for fighting an invisible person, per the invisibility superpower, rather than taking no penalties 3/4 of the time, and full penalties 1/4 of the time. Being a whole-ass wolf also allows you to track. You have a 40% chance to track successfully, and, by the way, it's a whole lot easier to follow a scent trail than it is to follow a trail using only visual cues. I mean, I grant you, tracking someone by scent through like a modern city street, that's pretty rough, but not as rough as like standing on the side of a freeway, looking both ways, with your teammates pestering you like, what do your wolf eyes see? What subtle cues have you detected that will tell us which off-ramp our quarry took? Nothing, don't worry about it. We'll just go visit some of his favorite bars and look for visual cues that he specifically has been there. it's almost useless. Like, unless you're chasing someone through the woods, tracking by vision is no good. Tracking by scent is good. And the percentage for tracking by scent is almost as good as the percentage for tracking by sight. Equally as good if you're tracking someone you've drawn blood on. So like if you're chasing someone from a combat, for example, which is a very common scenario where you've got to track somebody, or if you're tracking somebody who's been injured and kidnapped, then it's 50% either way. Except with Metamorphosis colon animal, all it costs you to know it is a less valuable 7th level spell slot, and you get to be a goddamn wolf instead of a poser stroking his wizard beard in the produce aisle, spouting off fruit facts, a quarter of which are wrong, by the way. The implementation of Eyes of the Wolf is the dumbest thing on this page, and it hurts me to say it because I like Eyes of the Wolf. It's a fun spell. It's flavorful. It gives you all these different assorted abilities. I mean, I love a suite of abilities, some of which are like your standbys, your staples you're going to use often, others of which maybe there's a chance it'll never come up in the campaign. But when it does, you're going to be the wizard who gets to raise their hand and have the big floppy wizard robe sleeve slide down it and be like, me, GM, I've got the spell that can identify that fruit, and that's great for, like, a second level spell. But for an 8th level spell, think of it this way. Spells are closely guarded secrets in the world of Heroes Unlimited. One of the most common and easy way to learn spells is to trade them with other wizards. I mean, wizards do guard their secrets, but consider, you know, you could be in, like, a magic guild, or you could know other player character wizards, and you could swap spells, right? You are going to be the loneliest kid in the cafeteria trying to swap this dumb-ass spell for other 8th level spells. Anybody got exorcism? Anybody got the ability to cast goddamn demons out of people? How about the one where you can make people permanently fall in love with you and become slavishly devoted? Negate magic, the ability to universally cancel the spells of other wizards? Or how about Metamorphosis colon human, the one where you can change your physical form into the form of any other human being, the perfect disguise? Anybody got any of those? I'm looking to trade Eyes of the Wolf. 70% chance to identify an unknown fruit. Come on, guys. You can track people in natural environments. It works, like, half the time. Ugh. Does not need to be an 8th level spell. Does not need to be so expensive. And especially, you know, it's on the very next page from a spell that actually turns you into an actual wolf and gives you virtually the entire utility of this spell. For the same price, and by the way, it lasts over twice as long, and by the way, you get to be a goddamn wolf. Oh, just as a little bit of bonus content, the spell right below Eyes of the Wolf is the spell Locate, which when you cast it in the standard way, like not as a ritual, but just the standard way, has a 41% success rate that never rises. So if you're feeling bad about your fruit trivia score, just keep in mind, at least you're not the sad sack spell scribe who decided that a locate spell that works less than half the time is finished and acceptable and ready for press. It's the fucking Kevin Sambita of the mythic past. It really is too, because the ritual version works like 88% of the time, which is decent. But the invocation, it's like, well, it doesn't do what it says it does, and it doesn't work, but it's quick. Anyway, alas for Eyes of the Wolf. A cool spell. Could have been implemented a lot better. I would definitely house rule it in my own campaign, because this is a spell I would like to see have a lot of play. More than it will get in this sorry condition. Join me next time for a spell with much deeper problems on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Before today's episode, I want to give a content warning, and there are no jokes in it, because you're about to hear plenty of them. This episode centers on pretty facetious treatment of a lot of serious things. They include violence against children, sexual assault and coercion, stalking and harassment, suicide. Pretty much all of these topics are suggested by the contents of this page, believe it or not, and their presence in this usually goofy RPG is more or less the topic of this episode. So if you're sensitive to any of those things, or if you just don't want to joke around about them right now, this is maybe not the ideal time for this episode to drop, given all that's been going on in the tabletop gaming world recently. So if this doesn't sound like it's up your alley, or it's not up your alley right now, this is your warning. If you'd like to skip ahead, the next episode begins at the 50-minute mark. Today we're discussing page 332 of Heroes Unlimited, and it's going to be a bit of a heavy one. We're in the magic section. We're still making our way through the spell list, and we've really gotten into the heavy-duty spells now. We're on to level 8 spells. Many of these spells are very potent. Stone to Flesh is on this level, which is, you know, despite my mockery of it days ago, a fairly useful spell. It permanently turns stone into flesh, so you can turn, you know, a section of a stone wall or something permanently into meat that you can hack through. Certainly useful in, like, a dungeon environment, maybe less so for a modern game. But that's really the only dubious one on this page in terms of power level. Wisps of Confusion gives an average of 5 people at once pretty big debuffs. Negate Magic, of course, the true calling of every wizard to cancel out other wizards. Gotta have Negate Magic. Metamorphosis colon human allows you to turn yourself into a whole other person. Great for disguise and impersonation. I'm not finding fault with any of these on power level, including the one I want to talk about today. The first one that appears on this page, Love Charm. I don't really know how this episode is going to develop, but I feel that it might be a bit of a heavy one. It might be both heavy in the sense of like serious topics, in the sense of being like one of my preachy episodes, which I know you all love. You all look forward to the day when instead of hearing me spout my usual bullshit and be funny and make fun of superhero costumes, I just step behind the old podcast pulpit and give you a much needed lesson in right and wrong from no less an authority than a minor comedy gaming podcaster. Heavy in that sense. Also heavy though in the sense of like crunchy design stuff. All these issues intersect when it comes to Love Charm, because fundamentally, here's what Love Charm is. And this is like one of those generational problems in role-playing that we've talked about before. It used to be, back when, you know, safety tools for gaming meant like, remember to bring a life jacket if you're gaming on a fishing boat. It used to be that it was common for games to casually drop some real serious traumatic shit on the basis of like random roles and casual events in a game. The classic example is a situation where the player characters go in to like clear out some orcs in a Dungeons and Dragons campaign and then discover those orcs' children abandoned there, now without parents. So you've just killed their only means of support. The game dictates to you that all orcs will inevitably grow to be evil, and you've got no one to leave these kids with. So the question is, do we kill the children? Do we leave the children to die of exposure? Or do we venture into enemy territory with them with time and resources we don't have, knowing that these orcs will grow up to be evil because their race is always evil? Obviously, we've got some minor problems of like political correctness slash basic decency involved in this situation. But from a design perspective, the problem is, who wants to deal with this shit at the Thursday game session? I mean, me, but only when I'm ready for it. You know, if I'm playing a big, beefy barbarian who looks like Charlotte Flair dressed as Barbarella, and her name is like Hammerclit, that's a certain kind of fun to have with a certain kind of group in a certain kind of game. Quite incompatible with now having to look into the eyes of starving orc children and decide whether to put them down or loose them into the woods like feral dogs so that we can continue our mission. Like, I've played many characters who I would be fascinated to see them deal with this situation. Just not Hammerclit, all right? Like, leave me alone when I'm doing this. Older games often do not respect this. Oftentimes, things casually or randomly happen that bring serious shit to the table. Endangerment to children is one of these things. Another one, arguably much more serious, is sexual violence. There are various kinds of like sexual force and coercion involved quite casually with a lot of older gaming stuff. I mean, I remember being on the internet and seeing, I think for AD&D, it was like on Usenet or somewhere, somebody was complaining like, what about my character with high charisma? What do I do to like rein in this player character who's cheesed out their charisma or their comeliness or whatever, and now they're bending all the NPCs to their will with their charms? And the answer was, have them gang raped by orcs to like balance them. This was not uncommon sort of practice in the bad old days of gaming. For reasons that should be painfully obvious, this blind spot for like, maybe this isn't an appropriate or fun thing to bring to the table, tended to be a lot of stuff that like women and girls would have to deal with in their real lives very commonly, but were things that maybe teenage boys were a lot more comfortable joking about because it didn't really hit home. The real problem here, from my perspective, as someone who has been a shitty teenage boy, and still is in some ways, the problem is not addressing these topics in gaming, for sure. The problem is in springing them on people without a mechanism for them to opt out. And secondarily, in kind of a drier design perspective, the problem is having these things happen randomly. I mean, I love a Palladium table, and I love the freewheeling randomness of the Palladium system in some ways, but it's not a good mix for topics that are likely to be really seriously traumatic for people. And I'm not just thinking here of people who might take offense, however justifiably, at this sort of topic. I'm also thinking of people like, I know a lot of gamers, especially in Palladium fandom, have been in the military, and you could easily be playing with someone who is trying to have a good time, and maybe there are certain things they don't want to come up in the game. And views can vary and groups can vary on how necessary it is to have like very explicit and robust safety tools to make sure that person is safe. Maybe if they have, you know, an actual condition of some kind based on their experiences, versus maybe like if we all know each other and this is just sort of a preference or a distaste rather than like a sort of diagnosable issue, then maybe it's enough for us just to all know, like, we know Bill, we know what's up with Bill, so let's not go to certain places with him and then he feels comfortable saying, hey, let me, you know, step away, or hey, let's not, you know, could be kind of informal. The worst case scenario, though, is when we roll on a table that tells us this is happening. So it's like the rules of the game are saying, hey, fuck Bill, this is what we're doing. And that, I feel, is what's going on with Love Charm. So let's get to the actual rules, and you can see how much this spell kind of forces some unpleasant content into your game. So Love Charm is a spell that's got a touch range. It lasts 5 minutes per level of experience. It costs 40 PPE, so this is a big gun. Long story short, if somebody fails their save, they fall in love with the caster. If they fail, they love you, they trust you, they'll do whatever you tell them for the duration. However, they're also going to be all up on you. It says here, quote, "The charmed person will constantly stay at the caster's side and will often suggest amorous pleasures," which is like 10 times as creepy as writing, "The charmed person will constantly try to fuck you." Like, ideally, you keep it in your pants, but if you gotta say, "Hey, I wanna fuck you," that's 10 times better than this milady bullshit with amorous pleasures. So far, so good, kinda. Like, it's a spell you cast for a desired effect, you get the effect. You know, there's a problem with maybe casting this on other player characters so that someone has to, like, roleplay wanting to fuck you, but that's, like, more general PvP stuff, right? If we're a table where people can freely abuse each other's characters and screw up each other's gaming experience and make each other play things we don't want to play, then we've already got problems, and this just sort of exacerbates them. We really run into trouble with side effects. Now, side effects don't just apply when you screw it up, like when you cast the spell wrong. You always roll on this table, and there's a 50% chance that there's no side effect. But the other 50% of the time, some bad shit can happen. So let's take a hypothetical example. And let's assume someone who used this spell, like, in good fun and good faith. Let's say we've got a character who's trying for sort of like a sex farce vibe, right? Like, let's say we've got a caster named Allison, and it's like the Miller's Tale. And so you're trying to do something really fun where there's this annoying dude, and Allison wants to cast a spell on him, Love Charm, to make him love her so she can then trick him into literally kissing her asshole, just like in the Miller's Tale, because English literature is extremely classy. So Allison casts Love Charm. What happens? 50% of the time, he does it. He kisses your butt, laughs all around, pass the pizza. We're all having a good time here, to the extent that we enjoy asshole kissing in our superhero role-playing experience. But that's the 50% of the time when there's no side effect. If there is a side effect, there is all told a 5% chance that things get real dark. This guy, he may kiss your butt. Sure, he might. Haha. Funny joke. However, he also demands affection from you. He demands your love, probably demands sex, and if he doesn't get it, he commits fucking suicide. This is dictated by the rules. It's a balancing factor on the spell, so this is not something you can just readily ignore. You have to cope with a 5% chance that when you try to play a funny joke on someone and get them to kiss your butt, you accidentally cause them to demand to fuck you and then kill themselves. I mean, unless you fuck them. Unless you're, I guess, a principled or scrupulous alignment, and you feel like, okay, I cast this spell, this person's life is now imperiled, I guess I have to have sex with them, otherwise I'm morally responsible for their suicide. This is some real dark stuff. Like, all I wanted was my butthole kissed. Now we got this whole complicated rapey moral dilemma happening, based on a random roll, too. So already we've got sexual coercion, we've got a moral obligation to have sex with someone, so that's a consent issue right there. We've also got suicide, all on the table now. Other things that can happen. For 1 to 4 days, the target demands your quote-unquote affection and will stalk you, possibly harass you, and will use violence against your friends if you don't give in. So Allison is just out for a good time. Allison just wants her butthole kissed because it's funny, not in a sexual way, right? She wasn't trying to be creepy. She just wanted to have some good old-fashioned fun getting a creepy guy to kiss her butthole. Now, for multiple days, she's got like a violent stalker threatening to slit her friend's throats unless she fucks them, based on a random roll. And 1 to 4 days is getting off easy. There's a decent chance when you use this spell that you get that same effect, but permanent. You've now introduced as a permanent element of the campaign that you have a violent stalker who is trying to coerce you into sex. And of course, there's an 8% chance, all told, that instead of attacking your friends, the stalker simply attacks you, and if you don't fuck him, then he tries to murder you. So we've got stalking, we've got sexual harassment, we've got abusive relationships, everybody in. The train to Funtown is leaving soon. Sexual assault, suicide, there's barely room for you. You gotta hang on to the sides. We're taking off. This isn't even a good way to tell a story about, like, stalking or domestic abuse or anything like that, because it starts with the victim, the person being stalked, bringing it on themselves by casting this spell. So I don't even want to say this spell is the dumbest thing on this page because it's not specific enough. Here's the problem. Thinking about how this all plays out for, like, Allison or, you know, whoever, whatever hypothetical character takes this spell. Let's say you're a player who, for whatever reason, you read this spell, and it doesn't immediately set off warning bells for you. Like, maybe you're somebody who comes to this from a very tactical, RP-light background in role-playing. Somebody who's really used to, like, dungeon crawls with, like, very paper-thin character avatars for the players. You know, you solve puzzles, you kill monsters, you collect loot. You might easily look at this spell, this 8th level spell, which is pretty heavy duty, and think, okay, this is kind of like a phantasmal killer in a sense, because you can use this spell to make someone love you and then tell them to commit suicide. They do get a second save. So again, like Phantasmal Killer from Dungeons and Dragons, they get two saves, but if they fail, they're just dead outright. Against many foes, this is, if nothing else, a whole lot faster than trying to whittle away somebody's SDC or hit points with, you know, your Energy Bolt, your Fire Blast, your Call Lightning, etc., etc. So you might look at this and think, well, hey, this is a hell of an offensive spell. Two saves away from instant death, essentially? Sign me up. I want that. That'll be a great way to take down intelligent enemies that I can't harm because they're, you know, too physically tough. By doing this, and then adjudicating the spell as written, this player is now forcing the GM to pretty much routinely play NPCs who fall in love and then commit suicide out of heartbreak. Also, to take NPCs who just existed already in the world and were in your way, maybe as a player, and because of the side effects of the spell, are permanently transformed into abusive stalkers who attempt to coerce sex from a player character. That spills out, too. Like, they're going to start going after the other characters. This is, like, really serious, dark, real-world stuff. Targeting people's friends, threatening suicide, trying to emotionally manipulate people into sex. You're obliging the GM and the other players to have this in the campaign by taking and casting this spell. Now, I grant you, this spell does say, quote, characters of a good alignment try to avoid using this magic. Yeah, I fucking hope so. Like, this, I mean, this is an outright violation of consent. This is overwrite someone's will with an unreasoning trust for you and desire to fuck you to the extent that they will kill themselves on your command. It's not the kind of thing I can see Superman doing, to put it mildly. So maybe this is not like a highly encouraged player character option, but this game explicitly allows for playing non-good player characters, and it demands that you play those non-good player characters in character, just as selfish or as evil as their alignment would dictate. So either we're talking about a player playing an evil character and using this spell indiscriminately, a good character casting this spell only in dire circumstances, like Lord Ruthless is about to destroy the city, we haven't been able to beat him, we've got no other choice, let me put the whammy on him so that he wants to fuck me so bad he commits suicide as a line of last defense for the city. Like, even though it's like pretty morally questionable, it's better than having the nuke go off. Or we're talking about an antagonist having this spell and using it on NPCs or, God forbid, player characters, forcing them to become either stalkers or unwilling suicides. There's basically no good outcome here, at least for most campaigns. I can very easily imagine, like, a very dark campaign where we have a character who has the ability to do this to people's minds and really doing some intensive storytelling about just how grim this kind of power is. Heroes Unlimited is not that game, at least not for the vast majority of campaigns. The dumbest thing on this page is that there is no mention of checking in with other players or the GM before taking this spell. You don't get that many 8th level spells. So if you take this at character creation, let's say you make your character independently, as was the practice back in the old days of gaming. You make your character at home and then, you know, bring them to the table and the GM figures it out. If you take this spell, it's a huge part of your power base. And for it to work, everybody else at the table just has to accept that we're going to be dealing with, like, a lot of heartbroken suicides and a lot of abusive stalkers and a lot of semi to non-consensual fucking in this campaign. And that is not a cool thing to spring on other people. So yeah, the dumbest thing in this page, and it is because this game is of its time, is that there's no mention of sort of checking in to make sure that everybody's okay with this being that kind of campaign before you take this spell. I honestly think it's just that at this time, most role-playing game designers and players somehow didn't have a sense that this could be a problem for people. It's weird to think back on now, but I think that was the assumption for a long time, that we were just all comfortable playing this sort of thing out if the dice fell that way. I mean, hell, I'm guilty of this. I had a vampire campaign where I had what I continue to think was a pretty cool plotline where one of the player characters, Ghouls, who she'd had to embrace over the course of events in the campaign, he was no longer happy just being a servant to her, had fallen in love with her, and ended up killing himself because she didn't want to be with him. I think it was dramatically quite good, but looking back on it, I absolutely should not have pulled that without some real explicit conversation about where it was going with the player, because that's how we played at the time. But the fact that it was a very common design problem in games from this time period does not mean it wasn't a design problem. It always was. It was always dumb. Gaming as a culture just didn't notice that it was bad design until embarrassingly late in the day. But here we are, and knowing what we know, this is the dumbest thing in this page. I would never take this spell without consulting with the group. And frankly, I would never take this spell. It just seems unpleasant to me. But if I, for some reason, had like an irresistible character concept that demanded that I use a spell like this, I would absolutely clear it with other people and, you know, offer to maybe rework the spell. Because maybe I want to spend my Thursday nights playing stories about suicide and sexual assault, but maybe somebody else at this table is just here to play Hammerclit, and I gotta respect that. Anyway, that's enough of the serious stuff. Join me next time as we discuss a design oversight that I take as a very personal affront on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 333 of Heroes Unlimited. We're still in the spell section, and we're onto the truly huge spells now. Ninth level spells begin on this page. For the most part, these spells are quite good. Age prematurely ages people. Havoc is a very powerful debuff. Speed of the Snail is a huge debuff that even affects golems. So if one ever starts to exist, you'll be ready. There's only one spell on this page that I take issue with in terms of power level, and that's Water to Wine. Sincerely, I have no idea how this spell got to be ninth level, except I guess maybe just on religious grounds. Like, you know, maybe somebody realized if Water to Wine is like a third level spell, we're maybe implying that Jesus was only third level, and that seems somehow wrong. It seems somehow sacrilegious. I think maybe it just seemed wrong to make one of Jesus's classic miracles a low-level spell that any scrub wizard can do, but it should have been. I mean, in the context of all this, I'm not trying to get into any theological debates here. I'm not trying to deny that Jesus could have cast Speed of the Snail or Monster Insect if he'd wanted to, but you know what? He had the virtue of humility, and he stuck to an effect that, let's be honest, it belongs at like second level. I think this religious thing is what's going on here, because Swords to Snakes is also a ninth level spell, and it maybe deserves to be on the basis of power level, but it also is strongly reminiscent of the story of Moses, so I think maybe spells that are in the Bible, just for PR purposes, just for optics, need to be ninth level plus. Anyway, I do object to a spell that does nothing but turn water into wine being ninth goddamn level, but that's not even the dumbest thing on this page. The dumbest thing on this page is a spell I just mentioned, a spell called Monster Insect. It turns an insect into a monstrous creature the size of, quote, a dog or horse. Quote, the creature will obey simple commands from the mage who created it and is very aggressive, will fight to the death. Fair enough so far. Turn a bug into a deadly monster that fights your foes? That sounds like ninth level wizardry to me. My problem comes with the next and final segment of the spell. Quote, a typical monster insect, ant, beetle, bee, etc. And then a stat block. Just a simple stat block that lists a horror factor, a couple of options for armor rating, a single variable hit point and SDC total. Here is my objection, and it is simple, but it burns so much. Motherfuckers, I did not sit through four goddamn pages of bug rates to have you not even mention that this book has four pages of giant bug stats in the giant bug spell. What about all those ants and bees and hornets and scorpions and fucking jumping spiders? What about the giant puking grasshoppers? Didn't that mean anything to you? Don't you even remember when I had to spend four pages of this podcast and my life just bullshitting my hardest to get through the absolutely minimal interest in laboriously describing various species of giant insect, just to have this spell, the monster insect spell, say, you know, for the purposes of abstraction, for game rules, all giant bugs are basically alike. Here's a simple stat block. Takes 10 lines. 10 lines. This is insulting on two counts. Number one, that this stat block is so short. For all the detail that I had to sit through about all those other giant insects, which, by the way, long story short, if you're just joining the podcast, there's a control insects superpower that gives you the ability to enlarge and control insects. And it's not enough just to have a short description of, okay, you can make insects big and you can control them. No, the game takes a break from describing other superpowers for four goddamn pages to give stat blocks for all the different species of insects you might want to enlarge and arachnids. It was a little series of like four episodes called Bug Rates that I did earlier in the season. That's what I'm talking about. Those stat blocks were so long and so detailed. For this game now, at this late stage, to tell me that 10 lines is enough to describe not just one giant bug, but all giant bugs, is a slap in the face. Secondly, though, it's not just that it's so short, it's that it's so long. As I've been continually lamenting throughout this section, the magic section is overstuffed. There's way too much to fit into this section in too short a space, and the choices made were terrible, right? Almost every page, I've been complaining about something that is too long or shouldn't be here at all. But at least they're cuts. At least they're things that, like, I don't think we need both Energy Field and Mystic Shield, but they are two slightly different spells. If we cut one, we wouldn't have it anymore. We wouldn't have that slightly different version of a field of magical meat that stands in the way of bullets for you. It would be an easy cut, but a cut. All this spell does is make giant fucking bugs. This book has 4 pages of painful detail about the stats of various kinds of giant bugs. If instead of this 10-line stat block, this spell simply said, see pages 262 through 266, not only would it have been 9 lines shorter, but it would have had more information, rather than this generic stat block, which, by the way, does not differentiate between dog-sized bugs and horse-sized bugs. So what we're getting in this spell description literally is a stat block that's meant to apply equally to an ant the size of a Dalmatian and a wasp the size of a horse. Referencing the earlier rules would have been shorter and better. I can't believe they didn't do it. I can't believe they didn't take advantage. I mean, there's so much... I can't believe I'm even going to say this. There's so much useful information in those bug stat blocks back under control insects. For example, their habitat is listed. If you're a wizard and one of your rare 9th-level spell slots is monster insect, you're going to need to know which bugs are around constantly, all the time. You're going to get an app on your phone that locates like concentrations of local insects, like spider, but with no E, just S-P-I-D-R, like Grindr, but instead of finding dudes to fuck, you find spiders to feed people to. And that information, that information is in this book. It is in this book. But you wouldn't know it if you were a wizard, because why would you ever go dig around in the superpower section? You don't have superpowers. You have spells. Sucks to be you. All you get is the one generic bug. Little knowing that like 70 pages away are all the bug stats you could ever want. But the author just neglected to tell you. Oh, makes me so mad. To fill 4 pages in this bloated ass book with rules for giant bugs, and then later when giant bugs come up again, to ignore those rules and write new ones? Ugh. You go straight to game design hell for that. Anyway, I'm now incapacitated by anger, so it's a good thing there's nothing else to really talk about on this page. There are no more spells for Blindwatch here, and I don't really need to fulfill my vow and give you something from Heroes Unlimited Revised to put on this page instead, because everything here belongs in this game, at least. Water to Wine should probably be another level, and Monster Insect should be written differently, but they're both fine spells. I'm cool with them being in this section, so we're done for today. Today we're discussing page 334 of Heroes Unlimited. Today we are in the magic section, we're in the spell list, and we are beginning level 10 spells. These are big, big spells. We're in the home stretch now. There are only 15 levels of spells, and the high levels of spells are not well populated. For example, there are only 5 level 10 spells. These spells represent massive attainments of arcane power, spell levels many characters never achieve, and they deserve to be compensated accordingly. I'm sorry, did you think this was a gaming podcast? I'm here to talk about labor rights, albeit the labor rights of wizards. But before we get into that, first of all, half of this page is not spells at all. It's a giant illustration. You can find it on the Instagram. I'm only going to talk about it briefly, but I bring it up because it is acceptable. I've complained about the art in this section. A very low bar has been set, and this illustration, you know, casually steps over that very low bar. It's a perfectly nice, well-drawn illustration of a man who's got this kind of disc of magical power passing over his body. It's about at his hip level at the moment captured in the illustration, and it's replacing what looked to be his street clothes. He's wearing some kind of slacks maybe, but definitely like civvies on his bottom half below the disc. But then above the disc, he's in his superhero outfit, and it is a superhero outfit. You can tell because of the fancy gloves and the mask and the anatomically suspect abs. It's a nice dynamic illustration, well done. It looks like a superhero, not like a wizard from another game line. Nothing here particularly says wizard to me, but it illustrates, plausibly, a spell that is on this page, barely. Metamorphosis colon superior. This is a high-level metamorphosis spell that allows you to transform into any other kind of creature. Another person, an animal, a monster, an insect. Although, you know, if this image is meant to illustrate this spell, then what this guy's doing in a very dubious crime-fighting move is jumping into the fray by spending 100 goddamn potential psychic energy points to put his superhero clothes on. This would be rather like a hardware weapons character charging into battle with his signature intimidation tactic, emptying the entire clip of his machine gun into the air. Impressive, yes, somewhat wasteful. Kind of getting things off on the wrong foot. But anyway, good decision or not, this is a thing you could do with this spell. The illustration does illustrate a thing that is on this page, so by God, I'll take it. given the competition in this section, Presto Changeo, the mystical clothes horse, is okay by me. However, here's a wizard who's really not using his PPE to full effectiveness. He's not using it to full advantage. This page offers a much better return on investment for a wizard fortunate enough to have 10th level spells. And that opportunity comes with the spell Dimensional Pocket. Now, this seems innocuous at first. It's basically a spell for creating a bag of holding. And it's not even a great bag of holding. If you spend 30 PPE on it, then it lasts an hour per caster level. So just long enough to kind of like sneak something in somewhere, get something past security, you know. Or if you spend 140 PPE, then you create a long-term dimensional pocket. And even this bag of holding, though, lasts 6 months per level of experience. So suppose you are level 6, you can make one that lasts for 3 years, which, according to the rules, is about as long-lived a bag of holding as you can find on the open market, like available for sale, as opposed to wizards' personal magical pockets and stuff. This thing about selling bags of holding turns out to be really important because, you know, in a world starved for bags of holding, the shitty bag maker is king. Even though you can only make a bag of holding that is a temporary magic item that lasts like 3 years if you're sixth level, that bag will have a retail price, it says here, of, quote, 90,000 to a half million gold. Now, we'll assume that's an editing issue and we'll use the usual highly convenient convention that a gold piece equals a credit in rifts equals one US American dollar, whatever year we're playing in. So in this case, that's $1,998. That's a ton of money. I mean, it says here the top end of what's available for sale is a bag with a 3-year life, and apparently those sell for $500,000. Now, I know what you're thinking if you're playing or contemplating playing a wizard. $500,000? My financial troubles are over. I can finally pay off this goddamn tower. I can start wearing really fancy robes, like Ric Flair. Not so fast. Bags of holding may sell for $500,000, but this is where the plight of the worker comes in. The spell description says, quote, the retail cost for such a bag can range from 90,000 to a half million gold. However, the maker of the magic bag seldom gets more than 20%. This is the dumbest thing on this page for a number of reasons. Number one, it's just weird for there to be a market for bags of holding at all. Like, in a world where people don't even believe magic exists, where very few people know about it, it's weird that there even is a going rate for bags of holding. Especially because this is a 10th level spell. Knowing how to cast a first level spell is exceedingly rare. Like, rare to the point of being a legend, you know, or a rare superpower ability. It's like being an alien or having a mecha in the world of Heroes Unlimited. You know, you might see it on the news, but this is not a common occurrence. Being able to cast a 10th level spell is vanishingly rare. And knowing this particular 10th level spell, it's kind of a seller's market. Speaking of, this is the second reason this is the dumbest thing on this page. Who the fuck are these middlemen, and where did they find the balls to go to a wizard who can cast 10th level spells and say, oh yeah, I can help you get that priceless artifact off your hands. I only want to take, let's say, an 80% cut. I mean, this is a very copacetic working relationship. You're a master of cosmic forces. I'm an entrepreneur. You know, you have the very difficult job of bending reality to your whim to create priceless objects of vast rarity. I have the equally difficult job of finding a person who might want to buy a magical artifact. You know, I didn't spend years in wizard school, but I've got people skills. I've got to cold call potential clients who might be interested in a priceless object and say, hey, can I sell you this thing? So it's only fair that I take 80 cents off the dollar. I'm not saying this shithead doesn't exist in the real world and surely in the world of Heroes Unlimited. No society in reality or fiction is free of this shithead. However, normally this shithead knows how to pick his marks. To go to a wizard who can cast this spell, like, okay, to research this spell yourself, using the self-research rules where you just get to straight up pick a spell when you level, you gotta be 10th level. That's after the end of most superhero campaigns. So like, whatever your climax of a years-long superhero campaign would be, where you like, I don't know, put Galactus on trial, or fight a cosmic war against the Shi'ar Empire, or seal Cthulhu in the depths of the sea for another millennium, we're talking about like your Doctor Strange or your Doctor Fate character. After he's done that, he then goes home and he gets a call from this shithead saying, hey, are you interested in having me resell your magic artifacts? I only want 80 cents on the dollar. That's some fucking balls. Especially because, you know, what does a middleman do? Find leads, develop and maintain relationships, maybe warehouse things securely so you can wait for the right buyer to come around. These are all things that wizards have a spell for. And I mean, all wizards are pompous assholes, but especially a player character wizard will never take this deal. Honestly, as a GM, the best value I could get out of this rule in this spell is to play the shithead NPC just trying to pitch this to a player character wizard with this 10th level spell, and no doubt an arsenal of other magical techniques to blast the shit out of a quote-unquote entrepreneur trying to exploit him in this way. 80 cents on the dollar. This isn't fucking Uber. I'm a wizard. What are you thinking? Anyway, all that notwithstanding, and the dumbest thing I think is that wizards are expected to take such a bad deal here. But even so, if you're interested in having a Heroes Unlimited character, and particularly a wizard, make a lot of money, this is the spell for you. Because making these bags of holding, even at low level, like as soon as you can get this spell, is vastly profitable. It only costs 140 PPE, which is a lot, but given that you're doing it like in the comfort of your own home on a day when you don't have any superheroing business to attend to, you know, on your day off from watchtower duty or whatever, if you got the 140 PPE, well, what else are you going to use it for? Changing clothes? Like this asshole on the bottom of the page? No. Make a bag of holding, send it off to your shithead middleman, collect that cash, especially because other character classes often need downtime, as we've often discussed. Hardware characters, other magic characters who need to go study spells with their ancient masters, even psychic characters without advanced trance will, from time to time, need to like just take a day to recover, not to mention healing times, right? If you don't have any kind of supernatural healing in the group, sometimes you'll need to take a day, wait for people to heal up. You can easily create a bag of holding every other day, assuming that like this really diminishes your PPE resources and you really gotta even meditate to recharge, even if you're doing it inefficiently like that, rather than visiting the zoo or chilling with your mice. Even if you're just meditating and regaining PPE the slow way, you can easily make one of these every other day. And even if you can only sell it for dollars, that's an $18,000 profit. In today's dollars, that would be $36,000. So, you know, assume this takes you 2 days. If all you do is make bags of holding, you're clearing like $18,000 a day, at least until you saturate the market. And it's not like you got a lot of competition out there. If the market will bear it, we're talking about an income of $2.8 million per year if you just devote your magical powers to creating bags of holding. That's in 2018 dollars. $2.8 million a year is not too shabby, especially given you might have to take almost a year of downtime. Like, while those other asshole wizards who don't understand finance and economics don't know the value of money, are off on a mountaintop somewhere contemplating their navels, sucking up to their magical senseis trying to learn anti-magic cloud or whatever, you can spend that same time just in your magical workshop cranking out these bags of holding. They're going to come back with their spell, sure. Anti-magic cloud, the reward for spending 8 months gaining enlightenment, whoop-de-doo. You're going to have like $2 million in the bank. No spell can accomplish what you can accomplish with $2 million goddamn dollars, especially the spells in this section. So this could really be a great living for your wizard player character or NPC, but it's still wrong. This income is still wrong. It's like professional athletes who, they make a lot of money, sure. And sometimes it seems crass or it seems ungrateful for people to complain. But the fact is, if the people above you who aren't doing the work are taking the lion's share of the profit and you're left with a fraction of the value of your labor, that is wrong. Wizards of the world, unite. Wizards should not and cannot continue to stand for this. If you're one of the rare people in the world, one of those exceptional human beings who are enough of a cosmic grade asshole to cast 10th level spells, you've got an ego that can tear through time and space itself, and you're going to spend your days cramped up in a workshop sewing leather bags for the military or drug smugglers or whoever. Your labor has value and you deserve to be compensated. I'm just here to stand up for these assholes against the other assholes. Anyway, if you've found my strident declarations about wizard labor rights off-putting, join me next time for a humbler episode where we discuss something I earnestly have no fucking clue about, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This episode of In Search For... presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones, to the mysteries of Heroes Unlimited that we will examine. They appear as mysterious apparitions in the rules of Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition, tied inextricably to magic and myth. These enigmatic beings are nonetheless distinct from the surprisingly commonplace demons and old ones, so horny for magic, who regularly pierce the veil to our reality at sites of significant tourist revenue. Unlike those supernatural predators, these beings are never seen, never encountered, never statted, obviously, but nonetheless, they have left a few unmistakable marks of their passing. Sometime, perhaps in a mythic past the author could never quite be arsed to describe, they walked among us on Heroes Unlimited Earth. Now they are nothing more than inexplicable references and loose ends in this otherwise immaculately constructed game world. Are you ready to hear what the pronoun they has stood for over this interminable introduction? Too bad. We've still got a dramatic pause to do. It's elves. The epicenter of the mystery of elves in Heroes Unlimited is undoubtedly page 335 a page of the overambitiously titled Magic Explained section that concludes 10th level spells and moves on to 11th level spells. Here we find a cluster of elf sightings that make it certain, disclaimer, not quite certain, that elves must exist somewhere in the magical world of Heroes Unlimited. Here we find the spell Finger of Lictalon. This is a powerful spell, a spell of legend, an intriguing phrase that is never defined in this book. Its meaning is unclear, but in this narrator's opinion, spell of legend might as well mean elves for sure. Just listen to the spell description. Quote, this spell, credited to the legendary elf wizard Lictalon, transforms an ordinary knife, sword, or spear weapon into a super powerful magic weapon. We needn't concern ourselves here with the mundane details of this account. For the curious, super powerful means still not as good as a machine gun, so what's the point of magic anyway? What's significant here is the mention of this legendary elf wizard Lictalon. Legendary. No hard information is given, and yet, like all legends mentioned by anyone at any time, we know that Lictalon must definitely, disclaimer, not definitely, be a real being in the world of Heroes Unlimited. A skeptic might suggest that this rules text was merely copied and pasted from another game line with no consideration to its effect on the game world of Heroes Unlimited, that there is no mystery here, but merely a thin premise to spice up this, the 100th MDC episode about poor editing. But skeptics are liars and they are assholes. Others believe that elves do exist, and must exist, somewhere in the hazy history of the Heroes Unlimited world. It seems impossible. Elves, as described here, would of course be the elves from the Palladium Fantasy role-playing game, who have a long and storied history, and this individual, Lictalon, comes from a very specific historical milieu, the elves' mythical origins in the Age of Chaos, the world-shaping and highly original elf-dwarf war that constitutes the backdrop of the Palladium Fantasy setting. Just imagine, elves hating dwarves, truly a fantasy concept that could only have sprung from the twisted mind of Kevin Sambita. Elves are not a generic fantasy race in this context, no. No, they are a specific species, a specific civilization. Lictalon is a specific historical entity, and yet his existence seems to be impossible in the history of Heroes Unlimited, which occurs in an Earth much like our own, a world whose history has no room for elven culture. Or does it? As usual, when we wish to imply the possibility of a thing we have just established to be impossible, we must leave this unsettling question with a question mark. Lictalon is not the only evidence that elves exist in the world of Heroes Unlimited, however unseen they may be. Also, on page 335, within the spell Summon Shadow Beast, we find even more inescapable proof, disclaimer, not inescapable, also not proof, that elves truly exist in this world. Unlike Lictalon, a shadowy figure of legend, the Shadow Beast is a shadowy figure of fact, a literally shadowy figure that can be literally summoned to literally kill the shit out of one's wizard foes. Unlike the elf, rarely mentioned and never statted in this game, the Shadow Demon does have game statistics. For example, skills of note. Quote, invisible in shadows and darkness. Prowl 90%. Climb 80/75%. I believe that second number is the Shadow Demon's proficiency at rappelling as distinct from climbing, just in case you're playing a basically benign mad wizard who just wants a rock climbing buddy. Land navigation 60%. Track 40%. Wilderness survival 80%. And can understand Elven and the language of his creator. All Shadow Demons speak Elven. So the Elven language does exist. Now, obviously, no one would invent a language for a fictional race of people. It simply isn't in the range of normal human behavior. It's as unthinkable as some creative genius in the pre-Sambita world inventing the idea of an elf-dwarf war. If the Elven language exists, all evidence points to elves existing, but where are they? Where and when? These spells are not the only sighting of fantasy creatures in the shadows of the world of Heroes Unlimited. The level 3 spell, Armor of Ethan, while not called out as such, does bear the name of Ethan, the legendary dwarven king whose armor inspired the spell. Once again, we find the magic in the world of Heroes Unlimited bearing the unmistakable mark of historical elven and dwarven personages. Personages who couldn't have existed here. Personages who do not appear in the canonical history of the Heroes Unlimited world, and yet whose names are inscribed on the canon of Heroes Unlimited. History itself is against us in solving this mystery, and so we must conclude that history, like a skeptic, is a liar and an asshole. Elves and dwarves undoubtedly, disclaimer, not undoubtedly, exist. The question is, when they became the basis for superheroic magic? If magic is a neutral force of nature that occurs independently on Heroes Unlimited Earth, as described earlier in the Magic Explained section, Why are key spells named after beings from another world? And perhaps most puzzlingly, what the fuck am I supposed to do with my Shadow Demon's elven language skills? Just have it chat up some other wizard's Shadow Demon in a language none of the humans in the room can understand? Seems like a bad plan. Perhaps the dumbest thing about this page, rife with a pair of elf sightings, is that they are so inexplicable. It would have been child's play to remove these traces of elves from the magic section of Heroes Unlimited, or to explain in a simple parenthetical statement that these were elves from the Palladium fantasy world who visited the Heroes Unlimited Earth in a distant mythic past. The failure to exercise either of these options is highly suspicious, and it leaves us, perhaps, with a mystery that we may, forever, remain in search for. MDC, Palladium Books, Heroes Unlimited, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Sambita. This episode's music, used under Creative Commons licenses, includes Phantom from Space by Kevin MacLeod, whose work you can find at incompetech.com, and To the Top by Midair Machine, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org/music/askagain. That's ask again, two words with a space in between. Next time, did travelers from the 79th Null Dimension visit medieval Europe? Join us as we go in search for... Time Lords.